important as the killing of white men. White mother sons, do you believe in freedom?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gary Young, a feature writer and award-winning columnist for the UK Guardian. He's based in the United States, and he writes a monthly column for The Nation called Beneath the Radar. His book, No Place Like Home, in which he retraced the route of the civil rights freedom riders, was shortlisted for the Guardian First Book Award in 1999. Gary Young also has made several radio and television documentaries on subjects ranging from the Tea Party movement to hip-hop culture. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gary Young.
Well, thanks for having me, Ian.
And Gary, I've been trying to talk to prominent lawyers, prosecutors, defense people, people down in Florida, people who understand the Stand Your Ground law and its genesis through ALEC and the NRA, et cetera. And what I find extraordinary about this case is that the entire narrative that the defense of George Zimmerman based their defense on is entirely speculative. In other words, there was no witness to what actually happened prior to Trayvon Martin being killed and when he was killed. However, the narrative before that happened is in fact on the record and is unassailable, and that is the 911 call where he was told by the police dispatcher to stay in his car and not to pursue this person who he considered to be a felon. He was clearly chafing at the bit to get some justice in his mind. So how do you explain that disconnect, that that part of the case was inadmissible in the trial?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I find most peculiar, because the tussle, the fight between Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin is really a case of he said and he's dead, because one of the people is dead already. That's why we have, you know, the trial that we do. So we only have Zimmerman's account and then some kind of grainy audio footage and so on. But what we know up until that point is that Zimmerman chased Trayvon. We know that. We know that because it's in the 911 calls. And we know that because Zimmerman is basically doesn't dispute that fact. And so that begs the question, when does Trayvon get to stand his ground? On what ground can he defend himself? That what I can't understand about the way this case is framed in terms of self-defense is how Trayvon Martin gets home that night without being killed. That what is he supposed to do? Now, we don't know, as you say, speculation what happens between him and Zimmerman. But let's just take Zimmerman's account, his account. According to his account, Zimmerman's account, he chases Trayvon. He follows him, then he gives chase. Trayvon fights back, gets the better of him, at which point he shoots him. So if he had not chased him, as the dispatcher suggested that he shouldn't, if he had not been suspicious of him, and we know that there were no ground for him being suspicious of him, there is no suggestion that Trayvon was in fact committing any crime, then Trayvon would be alive and Zimmerman would be going about his business. Now, what one lawyer from Florida said to me yesterday was, but following somebody is not a crime. Well, there are many things that aren't particularly intelligent that are not a crime, and this is one of them. And if you follow someone and you are the cause of an altercation, it beggars belief to me how then that becomes a question of self-defense.
And how does one get one's head around the idea that all of the 911 call and all of the time frame and the activities and the motives of George Zimmerman prior to the altercation, for which there was no witnesses, all of that was inadmissible, particularly the 911 call, which seems to clearly establish his intent and his prejudice against somebody that he thinks is a menace to society?
I really can't explain that. I can't explain it legally in terms of the case. What I do believe, however, is that if we look at this systemically as opposed to systematically, I do not believe that George Zimmerman woke up that day and said, I'm going to shoot a black kid. I don't believe that. But systemically, we do live in a society where, and we know this from the kind of accounts of stop and frisk in Manhattan and elsewhere, where particularly young black men, by their very presence, are suspicious. And that the authorities believe they have, therefore, the right to stop them on the grounds of them being there. And that this is, on some level, not seen as being a particularly peculiar thing that Zimmerman, as an individual, not as a representative of the state, would have the right and the authority to stop Trayvon and chase him and demand some kind of authentication for why he should be there.
Again, I'm speaking with Gary Young, who is a feature writer and award-winning columnist for the UK Guardian. He's based in the United States, and he also writes a monthly column for The Nation called Beneath the Radar. He has an article at The Guardian, Open Season on Black Boys After a Verdict Like This. And, Gary, we've had some violence here in Los Angeles, and the Crenshaw District, and briefly in the Baldwin Hills area. The Black Riders Liberation Party, which is a kind of neo-Black Panther organization, apparently were a part of this, chanting no justice, no peace. But by and large, there's been very little outbreaks and demonstrations of the very real anger that's festering here in the African-American community in the United States and in also in the white community. I don't believe that I think across the board people are outraged and quite puzzled by what has happened in Florida, although we have a history of weird things in Florida like hanging chads and butterfly ballots, etc. But this definitely takes it to another level. What's your reaction to the outbreak of violence here in Los Angeles, albeit not on a great scale?
Well, I mean, here's the difference between, I think it was Mr. Crump, the family lawyer of the Trayvon Martins, who compared Trayvon Martin to Emmett Till, the young black kid from Chicago who was murdered in Mississippi, and Medgar Evers, who was also shot dead in Mississippi by Byron Dilla Beckwith in 1963. And he said Trayvon Martin's name will go down in history like theirs. But there's one key difference between now and the 50s and the 60s, which was then there was a civil rights movement. There was a mass movement that was organized and could channel the frustration and the anger to very definite aims and goals in terms of getting rid of codified segregation and moves towards equality. We don't really have that now. We do. There are organizations like the NAACP, which is meeting over this week, and there are individuals. But we don't have a movement. And therefore, I think that, you know, it's entirely predictable that there will be these. There have been a number of kind of large peaceful demonstrations, and most demonstrations have been peaceful, but that there will be these kind of outbreaks of violence because people are extremely frustrated, and there is a sense that the law is not there to protect them, and therefore there is no sense in kind of in respecting it. I mean, this takes place among a kind of series of very kind of contradictory shifts. So you know, we have a black president. We also have a black community that has been absolutely hammered economically. And which is much more, you know, where people are more likely to, particularly young men, are more likely to go to jail than go to college. And so there is a frustration, it is a tinderbox is there. And a case like this, I mean, when the Watts riots broke out in L.A., it was over a traffic stop. When the Detroit riots broke out in 67, I think, it was over the raid of a kind of late-night drinking den. Well, this is a far more resonant kind of infraction than that. And on the subject of Obama, it's telling what we have as a kind of limit of kind of the benefits of a black president in terms of a black community. So in the beginning, when Trayvon Martin case was first being discussed last year, he says, if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon. And now he says, you know, we're a nation of laws, and which is beyond doubt. The question is, who do those laws serve, and what is the central purpose of those laws? Being a nation of laws is very different to being a nation of justice. So you have an entirely different response as the head of state. And so you have someone who says, I could be Trayvon's dad, but then responds not as Trayvon's dad. I'm sure Trayvon's dad is not saying, oh, well, we're a nation of laws and these things must be respected. As the kind of national arbiter of calm and peace. And it's difficult to see how there can be calm when a boy can be shot dead on his way home from a store, minding his own business, and nobody pays a price legally.
And Gary Young, in your article at The Guardian, Open Season on Black Boys After a Verdict Like This, you talk about the parents of black boys not likely to be feeling calm, parents of black men not likely to feel calm, children with black fathers are not likely to feel calm. I guess in a way here, what's required is for the rest of America to start feeling some empathy. I mean, all parents surely should recognize what it must feel like that if your teenage kid goes out the door, they may not come back simply because they look like who they are.
Well, that's right. I think that politically there was a real problem here. And even in Obama's statement that if I had a son who looked like Trayvon, you can't help thinking, well, is that what it takes? Do we not have the power of imagination to understand that even if your child does not look like Trayvon, that the loss of your child in such circumstances would be of immense concern if the person who shot him walked free for 44 days? That identification is fine. And, for example, I am the father of a black son, and I do feel this particularly keenly, but I don't think I need to have those attributes in order to understand this injustice. We're all human and we all have the power of intellect. And those two things, I think, should suffice for people to understand. Because if we understand this case in the context of the criminal justice system and stop and frisk and so on, then what we have is a system of policing and of jurisprudence that does not seem to be set up in order to protect non-white people's interests. And a system that is thus set up does not really serve anybody. It's not in anybody's interest to have a large section of the American population feeling that they are cast beyond the law. That would be a very reasonable conclusion to looking at the results of this case and of the other ways in which the judicial system operates.
Well, just in closing, Gary Young, do you think this is likely to revive the kind of moribund gun control debate, which has obviously been dominated by the NRA, and in spite of extraordinary brutal massacres of young children and the repetitive nature of these massacres that go on throughout the country and the mass killings in the sense that there's almost a competition to kill as many people in the shortest period of time with the most powerful weapons. And we have the most well-armed criminals in this country, and these well-armed criminals are now in Florida are now taking advantage of the Stand Your Ground law. So if you combine the Stand Your Ground law with the concealed carry law, all of which have been pushed by both ALEC and the NRA, you are really getting back to a kind of Dodge City frontier mentality and vigilante justice. And you would think that this case, where all of that is writ large, would be provoking some kind of debate beyond the very justified conversation we've had about race relations.
You would hope so, although I fear not. It seems as though America only really responds to issues of gun control or issues of guns when large numbers of people are killed at the same time, and usually when a significant number of them are white, unfortunately. And that those conversations then, like this, or those debates that are filtered through race, unfortunately end up being understood as sui generis, just kind of understood with, you know, within their own context. I think there is a very kind of a very real debate to be had. I'm British, and in general, British people don't carry guns. The police generally don't carry guns. And so while in many ways I would argue that Britain is a more violent country, you're much more likely to get punched in the face by a drunk person in many kind of market terms than you would in America, it's less deadly. And that, to me, seems to be a kind of lesson that's never quite learned. There are two ways in which you could go with the Trayvon Martin case when you look at the nature of it. One is, if Zimmerman had not been armed, Trayvon Martin would still be alive, even if he'd had that fight. The second is that if Trayvon Martin had been armed, then he may have shot Zimmerman. And that one logical conclusion to this is that, and I've seen this certainly on my Facebook page, well, maybe it's time that, you know, we arm more young black men. Maybe that's the only way that he gets home alive. It's a terrible conclusion. And yet, there is a morbid logic to it.
Well, Gary Young, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Gary Young, who's a feature writer and award-winning columnist for the UK Guardian. He's based in the United States and writes a monthly column for The Nation called Beneath the Radar. His book, No Place Like Home, in which he retraced the route of the civil rights freedom riders, was shortlisted for the Guardian First Book Award in 1999, and he has an article at The Guardian, Open Season on Black Boys After a Verdict Like This. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about the population explosion in Africa.
The families and the students all confused and hardy. We've been through each other's arms. It's murder. New absence in the mother's arms. Even the warmth of a mother's arms could not keep a son from harm. Standing where the gun was drawn. Overcome, done and done, he gone.
Murder.
She'll shell like a bell and run. The blood burst, body temperature fell and plunged. And in the time it took the medics to come, the breath eased out of his lungs.